This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you.
Happy 4th of July to all my American brothers and sisters to the South. Welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Shane Told. I hope you're having a blast, fun in the sun, the very, very hot sun. Hope you're out on the patio with family and friends, grilling up some good food, drinking some ice-cold beverages. We just celebrated Canada Day. It's on July 1st. Perfect weather in Toronto. I just love it. Well, sometimes I choose not to do an episode this week, but I have one I want you all to hear, an absolutely great episode with a guy who has an amazing story, a pretty crazy story of how he got here. But this is a very entertaining episode. I hope you enjoy it, whether you're traveling, whether you're maybe taking a little break to walk around the block to maybe get away from the family. Sometimes you need a little break from crazy Uncle Ernie. I know how it is. But this week, Tommy Vext of Bad Wolves is here on the program. If you've been listening to any sort of rock radio, you've undoubtedly heard them covering the Cranberries classic Zombie. It is all over the place right now. A huge hit. But this is a great story of how this song came to be. Very, very interesting. Not just another cover on the radio. This is really, really a cool story. So sit back, enjoy. This is a great chat. Before we get into that, I want to thank everybody who tuned in last week for my conversation with Anthony Green of Circus Survive and Seosin. It was a huge episode. I had so much incredible feedback from people that have been listening to the show for a long time. New fans of the show, welcome. I hope you're back listening to this week again. It really is a cool thing, and thank you to Anthony, too, for an amazing outpour of honesty and emotion and everything. It was just, wow. It was a perfect episode, and thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in. As always, if you want to get in touch with me, it's very easy. I have an email address. It is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I read all my email. I try to get back to everybody. I know I had a lot last week, so maybe I missed you. I do try, and I do read them all, so please hit me up there. Feel free to hit me up on Twitter, at Shane Told, or at leadsingersyn, S-Y-N. I'm on Instagram as well. Check me out on there. And also be sure to like us on Facebook. What's up with me, you ask? Well, I just got home from Europe with my band Silverstein. We had an amazing time over there. Shout out to everybody that came out to Veinstream Festival, Grass Pop, Aerodrome Festival in Czech. We had such a good time. And now we're gearing up for 8 shows of the Vans Warped Tour. I'm looking forward to it, but I know I'm going to be very sad to see it over. Our last show is in New York City, and it's going to be like so sad and it all coming to an end after doing this tour Wow. I mean, I've been to it every year since 1997, and I've been performing on it since 2003. So make sure you come out and say hello if you can. The dates we're doing are Toronto, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Detroit, Buffalo, Scranton, New York, and Boston. So check out those dates. Tickets available now at VansWarpTour.com. Going very quickly. They've had a bunch of them sell out. So make sure you get tickets. Come say hi and come see us play in a very emotional and ripping, it'll be still be ripping, show at the Vans Warped Tour. I didn't take this week off. I almost did. Once in a while, I do take a week off. And for some people, I know it's hard. I know it's hard because some people love this show so much, and believe me, I love you for it. They love this show so much that waiting 1 week is hard, let alone waiting 2 weeks for a new episode. If you are one of these people, if you are a Lead Singer Syndrome super fan, please check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. For as little as $6 a month, you get bonus episodes, extra content, and of course, a great community with other fans of the show. You also get access to merchandise, question and answer sessions with me. I play some tunes on there, all kinds of surprises. We run contests, stuff sent to your house, all this stuff. I could go on and on about it. I just want you to check it out because it really is what helps me keep this thing going. So please, if you do listen to the show, if you are able to help out, go to leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Again, as little as $6 a month gets you in, and it really, really does go a long way. leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. And shout out to all my sinners worldwide. And another shout out to rockabilia.com. If you need merch, that's where you go. rockabilia.com, the best in the business. I am wearing actually a shirt that Rockabilia sent me. They hooked me up. They hooked me up with some stuff. It's an awesome Morrissey shirt. He's sitting in a chair, like getting his hair cut, like at the barbershop. It's amazing. It's super good quality. It's not crooked or anything. It isn't like some of the stuff you find on eBay or Amazon. Even Amazon has wrong bootleg crap. That's not going to happen with rockabilia.com. So head over there, use promo code PCJabberJaw, and you'll save 15% off your entire order today. Rockabilia.com, PCJabberJaw. All right, let's get in to this week's episode and my conversation with Tommy Vext of Bad Wolves. If I Hello.
What is up, dude?
Hey, man. How are you?
I am good. I am happy to announce that I just took a poopy.
Yeah, you're a little late. That's okay. Nature
apologies.
Calls. That's all right.
Yeah, I was like, I had my tea and I was like, oh, no. Oh, and I was like, well, it's better just to be late than to have to stop in the middle of the interview to go take a dump.
Yes.
As you know, it's not fun.
You know, I'm on this new movement and I know a lot of, you know, people might say, oh, it's not manly to sit down when you pee. However, I'm fully on the sit down while you pee train.
Really?
Dude, you got, there's a lot of reasons. The first reason is you're not going to spill everywhere. You don't even have to pay attention where you're peeing. Second of all, you can use your phone while you're peeing. It's great. Third of all, if, like, you know, you're peeing and you're like, uh-oh, this is not just a piss. You don't have to do the whole thing where you finish peeing, take your pants off.
And then turn around.
So I just go straight for the can, sit down, relax, take a load off, you know?
You know what's funny? I shit and then take a piss after.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
Isn't that weird?
This is quite a conversation already, but is it even possible to shit and not piss? Like, can anyone do that? You always piss a little bit.
Yeah. I always feel like after I take a shit, I'm like, let me just make sure. Mm-hmm. And then I just double check. I also wash my hands before I use a public bathroom.
It makes sense though. That's another thing. I've been saying this for years. So Here's the thing, right? So let's say you get up in the morning. Let's say you got a regular 9-to-5 job, right? You get up in the morning, you take a shower, you put your clean penis in your clean underwear and your clean pants, okay?
Yeah.
Then you go to work, you start working, you're getting your hands all dirty. The first thing
hold on. We got to think of, we need to talk about the treachery of the commute. Okay, first of
there's all. There's that too, yes.
Doorknobs, bro. If you have kids, forget it. Maybe you took your dog for a walk and it took a shit, and maybe you thought that you picked up the poo bag right, but a little spectacle of dog fecal matter got on your fingernail while you were throwing the poop out, and you smell, but you didn't really get, and you're like, okay, and then you touch your steering wheel, and now your steering wheel is covered with your daily dog fecal matter because such a small level, it's undetected by the human nose. And then you go to work, and you open doorknobs, and then even the doorknob to the bathroom stall.
True.
Okay, you got to count money, you pay the toll, and you reach for a pocket full of change and singles that have been in a stripper's butt, male and female. It's not a good look. You know, this is how people get pink eye.
This is true. But it's right. You're taking your clean penis out of your clean pants and putting your dirty ass hand on it. Wash your hands first. Then, wash them after too.
If you had like one of those CSI fucking goggles, like those CSI lights where they find the semen, and you touch your dirty dick on your dirty hand on your dick, your dick would look like it was marching in the fucking Eye of Sauron's army. Okay.
Oh, I appreciate the Lord of the Rings references. Oh man, this is great already, Tommy. Good to have you, man, on the show.
Thanks.
We haven't met before. My name is Shane, and I sing in a band called Silverstein. You sing in a lot of bands. You've done so much. You've been slugging it out for basically two decades.
I am old.
Yeah.
Yes,
so well,
old.
You know, we're all old, and it really is really great to see, you know, your new band, the, you know, quote unquote super group, coming in here. I'm hearing you guys on the radio. You guys are doing all these big shows. Like, I looked at your tour dates. Pretty much the rest of the year, you're playing a nice combination of big festivals, opening for other bands, and also some of your own shit. So it really is like, you must just be on top of the world, man. You must be feeling great.
I mean, I'm pretty tired.
There's the honesty.
No, I mean, I think like the guys in the band, we've all been in so many different bands and we've been touring musicians for so long. We're almost like, it doesn't feel like it's happening to us. I think that that's kind of been the overall undertone of the tour. Like we're doing this headlining run in the States that was, I was terrified to do because I'm like, our album came out May 11th. And I'm like, the band has been out. The band debuted, you know, May 11th of 2017. We did our first tour through our album cycle. So I was like, there's no way that we're going to be able to headline, you know, these rooms. And, you know, the shows are packed. They're sold out or almost sold out. It's kind of insane.
Totally.
So, so we're kind of like, oh, cool. Like, people like us. That's fucking weird.
Yeah, it's weird. And, you know, being a new band is scary enough as it is. But when you guys basically, like, your big single that's playing on the radio, I mean, you have three singles out and they've all done pretty well, but obviously the biggest song is your cover of Zombie by the Cranberries. And that being the focal point is, I don't know if that puts more pressure on you or takes a little pressure off, knowing that at least we have this one banger. It's like everyone's going to go crazy. But then is it like, well, what about these people that are coming out to see that song and then they're just to check out the show? It's like you have to impress your existing fans already, right? It's sort of a weird situation.
Well, I think that like this band for all of us, you know, coming from bands like John coming from Devil Driver, and me coming from Divine Heresy, and Doc being in God Forbid, and Kyle being in the early inception of In This Moment, and, you know, Bury Your Dead, like we're a metal band. You know, if you listen to our record, which is like
totally
a lot of the metal. Like out the writer ups and the reviews on the record were like, people were like, I came here to like, all the metalheads were like, I came to hate Zombie. but holy shit, these guys are brutal. You know?
Right, right.
So it was just like this overall, you know, I think that zombie is kind of a, it's been this very strange phenomena.
Totally.
You know, I think that, you know, there is tragedy surrounding the situation. Obviously, we were heartbroken when, you know, our collaboration with Dolores from the Cranberries, who wrote the song, obviously, when she passed, everyone knows the story. We were devastated.
Well, it was literally, I mean, for people that don't know the story, it was literally, as I read, you guys were on your way to, like, pick her up to record her collaboration when you got the news, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is crazy.
She flew to London to record vocals on the song. We had already recorded it, and it was finished, and we sent it to her through our label. And Dan Waite, who is the managing director of the UK office for 117, has been a family friend of Dolores for 20 years. They've known each other since they were kids, basically. And we merely were trying to get approval. So when she came back and wanted to sing on the song, like, I was a Cranberries fan as a kid. So I was like, oh my God, this is the cool, you know, I was like so validated and vindicated in our efforts to kind of make an interpretation of the song that I considered that was a masterpiece. It was ambitious to tackle the song to begin with. So to have the actual writer, the master, say, you know, to the apprentice, yes, this is so good, I want to sing on it. That, you know, it was beyond a dream, you know, and then it went from being this kind of euphoric, positive state to this like really sunken in, heartbroken tragedy. And then, you know, the ultimate decision to kind of donate all the proceeds to her children, you know, and just put it out. I don't think we had any expectations on what was going to happen. We just were like, well, you know, this happened. And I think the best thing that we could do is we'll just, you know, it was either shelf it or, you know, make them like use it to memorialize her body of work. And then in giving the money to her children, we kind of just put our hands off of it. And we're like, okay, this is not our business anymore. Like, this is, you know, this is us paying tribute, and that's that. And the world responded in this crazy way. So it's
kind of a beautiful thing. It's just amazing. You know, I first time I heard the song, I was on the radio and I heard it, and, you know, I knew that she'd passed, and I knew the whole story, and I felt like, okay, this is a song that's in, you know, tribute to her. And I felt a sadness, you know, I really felt something because, you know, of her death. But it's really, really kind of incredible. And this is how music is so open to interpretation, that if she had not passed, the song would have felt different, I think. You know, and it goes from a triumphant song that's almost like a rally song, you know, with like, you know, the lyrics in the song, like even how you updated it, I love that. The same old theme here in 2018, you know, based on the lyrics. I love that you did that as a rally cry, but now it takes on a whole different meaning, which that can't be lost on you. You must have thought about that.
Well, I mean, she, you know, Dolores really liked the changes. You know, I think that the reason that we wound up covering the song, because it had the song in itself, you know, the meaning behind her lyrics, you know, she originally wrote the song about the bombing in Warrington, England, by the IRA that killed two little boys. And, you know, it was really like a protest anthem of about collateral damage, that not like one life lost is too much. And you see the kind of world issues that we're having when it comes to terrorism, and also domestically in the United States, the mass gun violence that we're seeing. And you know, that was my original reasoning for changing those small, you know, those adaptations of the lyrics, because what she was talking about 22 years ago, 24 years ago, is almost more relevant today. When you consider the mass amount of damage, of collateral damage that's done when people are, you know, trying to either make a statement or whatever their reasons are, when innocent lives are lost. And so now, you know, since she's passed, it really, really galvanized the change, you know, and it's sometimes I don't, you know, on a spiritual level, like,
right.
Sometimes it's just, you don't really understand why things are happening in life and they just kind of happen, you know, and a lot of things in my life have seemingly been tragic and they turn out to be a certain way. I don't really know how effective we were in our efforts to try to make a positive out of such a negative thing. But that's all that we could have kind of hoped for. And I think that a lot of fans of the Cranberries and different generations, basically what totally. We're seeing on tour is parents, grandparents, kids, grandkids, all singing the song, you know, in these arena shows that we're opening for bands like Shinedown and Five Finger Death Punch. And they're coming to the merch booth and they're like, you know, oh, you know, I didn't know about this song and my daughter showed me the song, or like my grandson showed me the song and then I showed them the original. And so it's kind of, we're able to kind of transform the song to kind of pass Dolores' message on to younger generations and simultaneously mourn with other artists and fans who love the Cranberries as much as we did. If that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. It's an incredible thing. You touched a little bit on your, you know, your life and things in your life that have been, you know, tragic or hard. And I know, you know, you've had some shit go down in your personal life. And I kind of want to start from the beginning, if you don't mind. You know, I really think it would be do you a disservice to just gloss over the first, let's call it 20 years of your career that led you here, and how you got there. So, I mean, I know you're from New York. What was your upbringing like? I know you have a brother, you've talked about that, but a twin brother, but what was your upbringing like when you were growing up?
Well, I mean, early life, I grew up in like the 80s and 90s in Brooklyn, and things were a lot different there then. It wasn't you know, it was
no craft beer bars.
No, there were no craft beer bars. If you were like, I'm too light skinned to go to Bushwick, basically, like in the 90s, you basically get kidnapped. But you know, it was a different culture and a different time. My brother and I, our mother was a drug addict, our birth mother, and we were abandoned at birth and at Greenpoint Hospital. And my parents that adopted us, they're really nice folks. You know, my dad was a Vietnam veteran. He instilled a lot of those kind of Marine values, and my mom was a stay at home mom, and you know, they were just like nice Irish people. You know, my brother and I are mixed race kids. My parents kind of just, they didn't see that. You know, right. they were really awesome, and my dad was sober for most of the beginning part of my life, and we had kind of a normal life. You know, and my brother and I went to school. We lived in this Irish neighborhood. I didn't really understand racism until I went to school, because I went to a school and there was still segregated lunch. Like I went to school in Garrison Beach in 277 for my, I don't know what you call it, like not middle school, like, you know, from kindergarten up through third grade or some fourth grade. And, you know, there was hot lunch, which was all the black kids would go eat hot lunch, and they would eat in one end of the cafeteria. And that was like kind of state funded, government subsidized, sponsored food. And then there was, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was racist. And so the neighborhood was all Irish, like Irish and Italian. And they would send their kids to school with lunch and then put them in the opposite end of the school in the other auditorium in order to separate them from the black kids. Wow. And it was like, yeah. And so like, so when I got to school, everyone was confused because my parents were white and I ate cold lunch. My parents sent me to school at lunch. You know what I mean? So the black kids were like, why are you eating over here? And the white kids were like, why aren't you eating over there?
So it's right. Like, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just weird. It's like, it's kind of interesting to me because, you know, as I've gotten older, like, you know, Doc from God Forbid, he's in my band. He was my first mixed race friend. And we didn't meet till I was like 21. I never met him. yeah, I'd never met any. It wasn't okay.
My best friend in high school was mixed race too, and also you know, a rocker. So you know, it's you know, I'm from Canada. Maybe it's a little bit different, but you know, I never thought about it. You know, I
think times have changed drastically.
Yeah,
drastically. Yeah. Like it's almost like cool. You know what I mean? I go back to New York and I go to Brooklyn and like everybody's mixed everything, like mixed couples, and it's a beautiful thing.
Totally.
But you know, like not so long ago, it was not okay. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where like some of my friends' parents, like that I hung out with as like when I was like 12, would call me the nigger boy.
Jeez.
Like it was crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. So I always like didn't feel like I belonged or whatever. I never really felt like I fit in until I found the like metalheads. You know what I mean? And then I started kind of like getting into. I mean, I really, really was into grunge music. You know, my parents, my dad was a huge Beatles fan and classic rock. And obviously, coming from Brooklyn, you couldn't escape hip hop. So, like, you know, our friends were like in the Biggie and the Beastie Boys and NWA. And, you know, it was like we weren't allowed to have records with the N-word in it. So we'd have to steal them. Like, we would literally steal records. You know, like Black Sheep, Crisscross, and all this stuff. We were kids.
Yeah,
we were a little, like, hoodlums. So, yeah, you know, we would, like, steal CDs and records and tapes, and we'd make tapes and trade them. And, you know, and then I remember in 1992, I went to see The Crow, and I bought the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, I love the soundtrack.
And I heard The Badge by Pantera, and I was like, what is this, you know? And it was a rap, and I was just like Nine Inch Nails, Pantera, you know. My friends like Metallica, but I didn't like Metallica until I got older.
Oh yeah.
But I got into all that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, you know, my cousin had posters of Danzig and Megadeth on the wall. Like, I'll never forget. Like, I went in his room, and his parents were super mad at him, and he had put up the euthanasia poster.
Oh yeah, with
and
the
I was like,
yeah,
dude.
With the babies,
so
yeah.
Gnarly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, this is the most gnarly thing. I'm like, John worships Satan. That's so cool, you know. And you know, whatever. Like, and then one day, like, I was how did I start singing? My mother was a soloist in the church choir, and she always sang the Christmas, like in the Christmas thing every year. We'd have to go there, and I hated it, but obviously it had a good impact on me. Because I saw her singing every year, and I was like, I want to do that. And I had been listening to all these bands, and I try to sing along at home. And my grandmother's neighbor had a band, and I was like 14 years old. And they were like, dude, we're going to, you know, they were playing like White Zombie and all this stuff. And
yeah.
They had weed. So I was like... My brother went over there and to smoke weed, and they were like, man, we need a singer. And my bro was like, oh, my brother sings that death metal. Like, you know, he didn't know. He's like, listen to that Satan music. So they were like, so they called me over, and I went over there, and they were like, yo, can you sing? And they're like, what bands do you like? And I was like, listing the bands, like, okay, he's cool. And I sang, what was it? Stone the Crow on the phone to the
nice.
Drummer.
I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the drummer's name was Jim. His name was Jimbo, and he's like, okay, he's in the band. We got a show in 3 days. I'm like, where is it? He's like, at the baseball field at 5. Get ready for practice tonight. And I was like, okay.
I love it.
We were the worst band ever. We were called the Dogs of War.
Dogs of War. That's not that bad a name. I've heard worse, much worse band names for sure.
Oh, we changed our name to Maniacal Disciple soon after our first show.
So this was, how old were you?
14.
You were 14.
1996.
Okay, so we're almost the same age. I'm born in 1981.
Okay.
So
yeah, I'm 82.
Yeah, yeah. That's what blows my mind when you talk about like segregated lunch and stuff. Like Look, we're the same age. I can't even imagine that, you know, like just,
well, you're from Canada. Yeah.
I know, but still I you know, I guess there really is a difference, you know, between Canada and America. I don't, I don't know much about it. I guess, you know.
It's important to understand that at that time these are specific. There are specified places where that shit exists. It's not like everywhere.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, New York City is like a place where it's so much diversity. I mean, I guess that's not a new. That's a newer thing. You know.
Well, it's incredible. Know, if you look at like. There's a movie called 25th Hour with Edward Norton, and at the end of it, he talks about how, you know, at the top of 2000, 1999, every neighborhood was still segregated by race. It just was. Yeah. Like, the Italians stay with the Italians, and the Irish are over here, and you know what I mean? And these guys are over there, you know, the Chinese people stay here, and these people stay there, like, the Jamaicans are over here. The Haitians and the Dominicans don't like each other. The Puerto Ricans don't want to be called Dominican. The Dominicans don't want to be called Mexican. Like, right. You know, it's crazy. Right. It's crazy. It really, really mattered for a long time. I mean, to some people, I'm sure it still does. But
yeah,
we've kind of moved on in society from that. For the most part.
Absolutely. So, just to talk more about your family growing up. I mean, obviously, it's been talked about in other interviews and stuff that your brother was a drug addict. And you guys had obviously a big issue, and he's now in prison.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, my brother and I were like basically like it's interesting because to not include, you know, some form of mental health awareness would be not to tell the story in its entirety. My brother started being incarcerated in juvenile mental institutions from the time he was 10 years old. So no, my parents didn't know what to do. They didn't know what was going on. And so, you know, we went from having this kind of normalcy, this regular home life, to the cops being called. You know, he was very violent to my mother. My dad worked two jobs. So he just, and no one could understand what was wrong with him. And I didn't get it. You know, I'm like, I don't understand. Why don't you just stop? And he literally was suffering. I don't know if the word incarceration is the right word, but it became more frequent. Ultimately, my father had been sober for 20 years. He wound up drinking over it. And my mother took my sister, you know, and ran away. Basically, they moved away to be safe. And the house that I grew up in kind of changed drastically, almost overnight. And and school stopped. You know, it's all those things. Like, I was doing the band stuff, and then school it was just like I went from being a straight A student to not going to school at all. And then, you know, we had no money, you know, and my dad was drinking and he wasn't really present, so we sold drugs. And as I got older, it just kind of got worse and got involved with the wrong crowd. And You know, it went from being like getting in trouble or like getting in bar fights or getting stabbed or, you know, to eventually I wound up getting, by the time I was 20, I was 19 or 20, and I got run, like, I, some rival gang members broke my skull with a baseball bat, the front of my skull, like my head's been busted twice, and then ran me over with a car and beat up me and my friend. They almost killed us, you know, and that's when I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. And I was like, I'm out of this lifestyle. And I focused on music, and, you know, my brother kind of stayed in that world, and I took some opportunities. You know, I just like, I got a job doing security because I've always been a big guy. So I started working at nightclubs and venues in New York City where the concerts were.
Yeah.
So I started to learn who worked at what record labels. I would stand in the VIP and read the list of names. And I'd be like, oh, this guy works here and that guy works there.
Right, right.
Like, I could just, you couldn't just Google everybody.
Right. Google probably didn't exist at that time. It was probably still web crawler or Hotbot or whatever.
Yeah. So I had like kind of did that. And then I was, you know, the band that I was in, we got signed to Lakeshore Records, and then we went on tour with Candiria and Burnt by the Sun. And, you know, we were like, we're going to do it. You know, we're in this like van that had holes in it. It was just like rusted out shot.
Yeah.
And then the band wound up kind of breaking up. You know, I quit the band because people weren't focused. You know, they were like smoking weed and drinking and you know, they weren't really, they didn't want to make it. you know, and at the time I had a side project with Doc and Dallas from God Forbid. And I was kind of doing a side hustle. I wasn't focused anymore because I didn't believe in the guys. And then I found out that Dino from Fear Factory was looking for a singer. And I contacted him on MySpace one day. And I was at Purple Light Studios in Brooklyn where we had made our record and bands like Candarian, E-Town Concrete, and Hatebreed had recorded. And I messaged him, and he responded. And he sent me Save Yourself, and The Threat Is Real. And I went into a couple days later, I went into the studio with the drummer Candaria. He had a recording studio in Queens in Rockaway. And I recorded the demos there and sent them to Dino. And that's how I initially got into Divine Heresy.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I didn't really, he called me. He was like, "You're in the band, dude. This sounds amazing. Blah, blah, blah." He was super amped. And I was like, "Okay, cool." And basically I didn't hear from him for like a couple, like it was almost like a couple weeks. And he was like, "Listen, I'm doing the Roadrunner United. It's really important. Just sit tight." You know, and I was like, "Yeah, cool." So I used to work for the security company that ran those buildings, and I broke in. I broke into the rehearsals, and I wore my old security shirt and passed through security like I was working, and went upstairs to the rehearsals, and then changed my clothes, and then fucking hung out. And Dino was like, "What are you doing here?" And I knew Shadows Fall and some of the guys in Killswitch already, and I knew Machine Head because I was in their music videos as a kid. I was like a Machine Head fan.
Cool.
Yeah, so Rob Flynn had a show. He was playing a show at Irving Plaza the night that of the rehearsals and didn't want to sing. And so he knew I knew all the words. So he was like, "Yo, do you want to sing Davidian?" And I was like, "Yes, sick, sir." So at the rehearsal, I'm jamming Davidian with Dino and Adam Deuce and Paul Gray and Joey Jordanson. And, you know, Scott Ian and Andreas Kisser from Sepultura.
Wow.
And they're like, "Who is this kid?" So basically they're like, "Yo," they were like, "Do you want to sing all the songs?" And I was like, "Hell yeah." So I they would play a song and I knew every single song.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah.
And then we did Surfacing by Slipknot, and Corey Taylor saw. He had come in and was watching from side stage.
Wow, what a story.
He came on stage and he was like, "Dude, what the fuck?" And I was like, "Oh, hey, man." And, you know, he's like, "How did you do that?" Because he was watching and I can change my screams and singing voice to match all the singers that I was copying because I taught myself how to sing off a fucking boombox with a microphone attached to it to the records I love.
Right.
And that's how I learned how to do it. And then so he invited me to sing the show. And so I'm the only non-Roadrunner alumni that performed at Roadrunner United. And then I officially the next day was in Divine Heresy and moved to LA.
Wow.
Like, that was my audition for Dino.
Well, pretty, pretty cool story. And it's, you know, funny now looking back at that, how you met all those guys and you got this reputation. And now here you are finally with your own project after, you know, filling in for Snot. You know, filling in for Five Finger Death Punch, doing these other gigs to kind of get your name out there. And now it's like, all right, now I've got my own shit. So it really is kind of a cool story, but it's taken some time.
Yeah, it takes what it takes, you know. And like, you know, what, you know, essentially I wound up moving to LA and my own addiction issues caught up with me, you know. And so, you know, kind of this whole thing, that was the segue of me getting out of New York. Because for the longest time, I believed that my problems in life were because of where I was living. And I was like, if I could just get out of this neighborhood and move on, then I'd be fine. And so I moved to LA and like, but I took all my problems with me, you know, and like doing drugs and drinking excessively when you're, you know, an infant who is the byproduct of a mother who is an addict and abuse drugs and alcohol is not a good combination. It's almost like a sure bet. And so, you know, I did Divine Heresy and it was like, I struggled through, you know, I was like drinking and partying and I'd be sober for 9 months. Then I'd be drinking again. Me and Dino could not get along. You know, there's some things happen. I wound up, I was engaged. My ex-fiance lost her child, and I never really recovered.
Yeah, man.
And the band kind of broke up, or I left the band during, you know, through the infamous onstage fight with Dino. And then I had, and it was almost like that happened. And then, and losing the baby, I had no reason to not destroy myself. And I basically like went on a pretty rough run. I joined Snot. I was trying to keep up appearances, but deep down inside, I was suicidally depressed, and I was doing all kinds of drugs and just anything to numb out. And I wound up getting sober. You know, I wound up, and I lost everything. I was homeless. I had no money. I didn't even have a bank account, no car. I didn't have a bicycle. And I wound up, Sonny from Snot, him and his ex-wife moved me into their house. And then I started going to program stuff and getting sober. And then they helped me get a scholarship to go to rehab. And I basically went to a place called Genesis House, and I lived there, and it was like a rehab for musicians. It's some other notable artists had gotten sober there. And my whole life changed, and I didn't do music for a whole year, you know? And then, you know, as all these things are happening in my life, my brother is now selling drugs and getting arrested on gun charges. And
is your brother still in New York, or is he in LA now too?
No, he's in New York. And so he's in and out of prison, in and out of mental institutions, you know, getting booked on various serious charges. You know, there's rumors that of you know, that he's kind of, the rumors are going around, he's executed some people for some other people. Like, it got really serious. He got really deep in the crime kind of situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we were estranged. I don't know him anymore.
Yeah.
So I wound up staying sober. I stayed sober. I got sober and stayed sober. I'm still sober.
Good for you.
I moved back. Yeah, and I moved back to New York in 2010 to start a band with Doc, of all things. and one night, my brother had broken into my apartment. You know, he broke into. I was staying with my family where my family lives, and he broke in, and I kind of came into the house, and he was high, and he wanted me to help him murder somebody, and I was like, "You need to leave." Hmm. And he went to my neighbor's garage and got a crowbar and came up behind me and fractured my skull.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so I fought with him, and I wound up, my arm broke, and, you know, it was a nightmare. You know, I wound up, my spleen ruptured a few days later. Like, I basically made it to the hospital, and I was discharged from the hospital, and, Slipknot's old tour manager, Brooke McLean, took me in, and she had a place in New York City, and I was living with her. And like about 5 days after the assault, my spleen ruptured in a restaurant, and I literally like bled to death, and I was rushed to the hospital. It's crazy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those like kind of larger than life situations. And you know, things got worse before they got better. You know, it was like, I really had to, you know, Mia Tyler, Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, his daughter Mia is a friend of mine. And she drove from Massachusetts and picked me up when I got out of the hospital and took me to her dad's house. And her family took care of me while I recovered from surgery. And I had like something like 20 staples from my chest all the way down to my belly. My head was wrapped up. My arm was all wrapped up. It was pretty intense. And,
yeah, damn, dude, very intense.
Yeah, and then eventually, you know, I had to come back to testify against my brother. My brother found out that I testified on the grand jury. Most people don't understand how that works. Basically, like, if there's a crime, you have to go to the grand jury for the grand jury to assess whether a crime has been committed, and then it goes to trial.
Yeah.
So I testified on the grand jury, and my brother had bailed out of jail, found out that I had testified, and then took a contract out on my life. So he hired a hitman to murder me. So I wound up, I was out. I was actually like, by the time I recovered from surgery, I was in this moment asked me to sing backups with them on tour with Korn and Disturbed. So they had a song called The Promise, which was a single with Adrian Patrick from Otherwise. And there was some scheduling conflict. So they hired me and I went on this big tour. So I'm like, okay, I'm like, the craziness is over. I'm back on tour. I'm playing music in arenas. It's going to be fine. And as soon as I got home from tour, the police were at my apartment and they took me and put me in witness protection.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I lived in witness protection for like the next nine months, I think. And I bounced around from like California to Florida. I stayed with Jason Sukoff and A.L. Levy and Mark Lewis down at their place in Sanford for a little bit. And then I stayed with the guys in Mutiny Within in New Jersey. And then the FBI finally called my brother. It was crazy. And the guy who was hired to kill me got murdered. It was just, it's like it's gnarly.
Jeez, it's like out of a fucking movie. It's, you know, it's just absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's it all wound up kind of coming to a head, and I came back to the state. I went to New York, and I got a job, started working again, and went into court, testified against my brother. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. He got 17 years for attempted murder. He tried to attack me in court. You know, it was very unnecessarily dramatic after everything that had happened.
Right.
And then I had been in survival mode for so long, I didn't actually feel. You know, like I remember like some of my good friends are one of my really good friends is Chris Santos. He's a Food Network chef and he owns a couple of restaurants.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about. Yeah. I watch Food Network like 24/7, so I'm all about it.
Yeah, he's one of the guys that really helped me through that time. He gave me a job and I used to work for, I was a door guy at one of his restaurants, and our other buddy Dave Delzio is another nightclub owner in New York. And I remember them telling me, they're like, man, you're handling this thing way too well. And we're here if you need us. And I didn't get it. I was like, I feel fine.
Right.
And then basically once the trial was over, like I got all of my feelings kind of hit me at the same time. And I got suicidally depressed, like for real. Like I planned my own suicide. And, I was like in therapy because I have PTSD, and I stopped going to therapy, and I stopped doing, going to sober meetings and all that stuff. And
yeah,
it's crazy. I talk a lot. I do a lot of public speaking about anti-suicide because basically my story was this, is that what it boiled down to is that, I planned to commit suicide and I was going to throw myself in front of a train. And I went to the junction in Brooklyn to the J train because it was above ground. And I knew if the train didn't hit, if I didn't die from getting hit, the fall would kill me. And wow. The train was coming and I was like, okay, like I went there and I laid my suit on my mother, on my mother's spare bed to be buried in. And I went to go kill myself. And on this particular day, the train was coming and my phone started ringing. I didn't recognize the number. And wow. This kid, I answered the phone. I don't even know why. And this kid picked up the phone and I picked up the phone and there was a kid on the other line and he was crying and he was like, is this Tommy? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, but I'm kind of busy right now.
Jeez.
And he's like, I need help. And he wound up, it was this dude who I knew, he was the singer of a punk band in the city and he was like a heroin addict and he had just OD'd and he had OD'd the night before and he knew that I was sober and he needed me to help him get sober. So the train pulled into the station and I got on the train and I met him and then I sponsored him. And now we're like, now he's like my little brother. He's been sober for like 6 years.
Oh, good.
One of my best friends.
That's incredible, man. Like, I don't know if you at all believe in any kind of like spiritual stuff or anything, but that's like, that's those kinds of signs that happen in life are like, they, you know, it's like you wonder if there's got to be something bigger. Do you know what I mean? It's weird. It's a weird feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely believe in there's definitely something, some next level shit going on, you know what I mean? Because there's been multiple times where I should not be here, you know what I mean? Whether it was by somebody else or by myself, you know? And almost like these innumerable measures in my life where there's so many times where I was like, how can I possibly go on? How can anything get better from this? And that's kind of my message to a lot of people who struggle with depression and struggle and suffer is that it does get better if you hang
in there. And I tell people, I tell, you know, kids that too, because you have to understand a lot of people, I know you understand this, but you know, a lot of people turn to music because music's the only thing that makes them feel better. And a lot of people are going to turn to Bad Wolves and hear about your song and hear about your band and hear the passion, and then they're going to hear your story. And they're going to be like, this guy was literally about to throw himself in front of a train, and look where he is now with, like, you know, a song, a chart-topping song, like, you know, traveling the globe, doing all these incredible things. And, you know, you brought up how you're doing some motivational speaking and helping, you know, celebrities and everything, you know, with, you know, their own 12-step programs, all that stuff. You're you know, you're really helping out and doing so much more. So it's an incredible story and a very inspiring story. And, you know, you should be very proud. I hope you're doing okay because, you know.
Yeah, I'm doing good.
These are the kinds of things, like, people are helping everyone else, and then deep down inside, there's still the darkness, you know.
But it really is a beautiful thing
what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the confrontation of it is, what I found is that when those thoughts and feelings come up in me, it's that I need to immediately find someone else I can help who has it worse off than me.
Right.
Whether it's like, you know, and it's not like, you know, whether you go down and you volunteer to help feed the homeless or, you know, a lot of people are, you know, Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade just committed suicide. And people are like all of a sudden anti-suicide advocates when celebrities hurt themselves, you know, or take their own lives. But, you know, some of our own best friends are fucking depressed and we haven't called them in weeks. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, it starts here. It starts
right
so around
true.
Us.
So you know? True, man.
It's so a, it's true. Like a thing that's like not talked about, especially I feel like in America, there's a massive prescription medication epidemic for people who are struggling with depression. When a lot of the times I was depressed, it's because I wasn't living life right. I wasn't living rightly. You know what I mean? And I'm sensitive. So my moral compass and the way that I am is very, very sensitive. You know, if I do the wrong thing, I feel like shit about it. And that's okay. That's just how I am.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to live, you know, we have to be in observance of ourselves. Sometimes being angry and being sad means, yo, you got to change something in your life. It's either you either change it in yourself or in your surroundings, you know, and that's, you know, that's how to be happy. People always ask, like Heath Ledger was one of those guys he's quoted because he's like, oh, how's work or how's this or how's that? How's your career? How's your love life? But no one asks if you're happy, you know, because then we really got to answer the question. And it's tough.
Very tough.
Yeah.
Well, damn, dude.
Today I'm happy.
Dude, well, good. Thank you for this, and thank you for the very inspiring talk. Really, really great to have you. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but we got to talk a little bit more about the band and you know, something kind of to segue into it a little bit is the first track. You know, you mentioned about your upbringing, about being biracial, you also mentioned, you know, your kinship with Dolores. The first track, Officer Down, that really does speak to what's going on right now in America, you know, and obviously what you've been through. It's really is an intense way to start the new record, your debut record, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, the song, there's an intellectual design behind the song, and that it is perceivable from two different directions.
Yeah.
Now, you know, to not talk about the fact that, you know, law enforcement have shot and killed unarmed and innocent civilians of any race, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's like from being choked out, you know, in front of your apartment, African American man Eric Garner, to the guy who just got killed in Arizona, for having a BB gun, a white dude, because he went to pull his pants up while he was being, you know what I mean, being ordered to drag himself across a hotel floor. It's the issue is not being talked about. You know what I mean? And to me, the issue is that it's not all law enforcement. It's specific personality types and people and profiles that they're not looking at that are not capable of doing police work.
Right.
That's to me, that's the issue.
Right.
You know what I mean? And totally. So these incidents are, you know, these incidents are basically the media is manipulating what's happening in order to create more drama and social disorder that creates more fear and more shit for them to cover. So that if you watch the news and you see a bunch of stuff and you get upset about it and then everyone takes to the streets, the news has a bunch of, they have stuff to talk about for weeks.
Yeah.
And what they upsell their ad space. And like, it's not okay. Like, look, my deal is this. You can't actually say to me all of anyone is bad. To say that all police are bad is racism. It's just blue racism.
Right,
it's not.
Right.
It's an individual issue. It's like saying all white people are like this, or all black people are like this, or all Asian people are like this. And this kind of mass media discrimination that it creates more of the divide in our country. And we're not talking about solutions. And it's interesting to me because some people are so ignorant that they just they side one way or another. And being ignorant is not good. You can't say that the police don't, you know, these police officers did not shoot and kill these innocent people, because they did. And they don't have any consequences for it. You also can't say that all police officers shoot and kill people, because everyone would be dead.
You make a great point. I mean, totally, man.
But as long as the issues are convoluted and people aren't having intellectualized conversations about the true nature of the issues, we cannot find a solution. And the system is the problem. The right. police are workers in a system. The system needs to be on trial. The judicial system that allows for them to make these kind of, if any number of these police officers who were wrongfully committed homicide in the line of duty were put in jail, it would change a lot.
Well, that's part of the problem. And that's part of the problem why people paint all police law enforcement with the same brush, because they all say, oh, well, they all in the end, they all have each other's back, whether they should or not, because none of these police officers ever get convicted. That's not true, though.
That's not the case. For us, this is a highly controversial song where I've gotten death threats from idiots over this song.
Sure.
And I've had more than 10 dozen police officers come up to me and say thank you for talking about this.
Right.
You know what I mean? In a way that's not one or the other, in a way of reality.
Right.
You know? And the other issue is that the media created such a hysteria that it wound up taking people, it wound up taking the lives of police officers who had nothing to do with any of this. When you look at the shootings in Brooklyn, the cowardly execution style shootings in Brooklyn, where two cops were just sitting in their car, executed from behind. And the same way with Dallas, with the five police officers who were killed and the seven other who were injured and all the other people, because some guy went nuts, because the people believe the narrative.
Right.
There's no journalistic integrity. And you got to understand, some people are not well. We're also talking about the mental health epidemic in this country, that people are doing crazy things, you know, and they're believing what they see on TV. Anyone who is anyone tipping the scales anywhere near schizophrenia or any kind of psychosis like that, they believe this stuff is reality.
Totally, man.
You know, anyway, totally. So I could go on and on about
and maybe we'll have to have you back for a part two at some point. Once you get going, album number two or more news comes with the band. It's so good to have you, man. Real quick, let the people know what's coming up. I know you're doing a bunch of headline shows. I see Gramercy Theater in New York. That must be cool for you. And all these shows, Shed Tour with Five Finger Death Punch and Breaking Benjamin. What else is going on?
I know that we're doing some of the Wimmer festivals, like Aftershock coming up. And I think, what is it? Is it Rocklahoma? We're doing, I don't have the list in front of me, but we're doing several things. And then we have We're in between. We're on the fence trying to figure out if we're going to go to Canada or Europe for November, December. We haven't announced it yet because we haven't figured it out. So our agent is figuring out this week.
Cool.
But we will be in either Canada or Europe for November, December on an arena tour.
Awesome.
That is yet unspecified.
Very, very cool, man. Well, hey, thank you very much for your time. And where are you right now?
We are in, where are we? King of Prussia on a day off at the mall. And it's right outside Philadelphia, about 20 minutes or 30 minutes from Philly.
Perfect. Well, enjoy. Enjoy a little bit of rest. I know you're tired. So, yeah, man. Thanks again, Tommy, for everything.
All right. Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
I'll see you around.
Bye. Cheers.
So there it is with Tommy. What a guy. So much there. Crazy stuff. Some of it pretty dark, but some of it also very uplifting. And everything he's done now with his speaking and everything, I wish him all the best with that. And of course, ongoing continued success with Bad Wolves. Go see them. I heard they put on a ripping show. So if they're in your town, go check them out. Well, I don't want your veggie burgers and your veggie dogs getting cold out on the grill. Maybe your drink's getting a little warm in the sun. So head on back outside. Enjoy the rest of your 4th of July. But before you go, I will leave you with a tune. And what else? I'm sure you've heard it, but let's hear it again. The emotion, the power, it's all here in this song. Here is Bad Wolves and their cover of the Cranberries' Zombie. Peace and love. See you next week.
Another head hangs lonely. Giant is slowly taken. And the violence causes silence. Who are we mistaken? Silence, we must be mistaken.